Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Democratic presidential candidates are getting ready for their debuts on the debate stage next week. Meanwhile, President Trump announces his re-election bid today at a rally in Florida, facing so far just one GOP opponent. All in all, there's been a lot going on, so today on The Exchange, we offer a refresher on who's who in this group of candidates, and we'll touch on the issues, too. We really want to hear from you. Who have you seen campaigning in your city or town? What did you think? And who are you still waiting to hear from? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. With me in studio, Meg Heckman, assistant professor at Northeastern University School of Journalism, a former reporter for the Concord Monitor. Meg, it's great to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Paul Steinhauser, a New Hampshire political reporter who writes for the Concord Monitor, Seacoast Online, and nationally for Fox News. And Paul, a big welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks, Laura. Good to see you.
And also with us, Dante Scala, professor of political science at UNH and a fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy. And Dante, thank you for your time as well. I always appreciate it.
You're welcome. Good morning, Laura.
Well, and let's talk about the Democrats first, because there are so many, lots to keep track of. And Dante, what do you see as the most significant developments recently as this field shakes out, this very large field?
I think now we're after 6 months of the year, we're starting to see the field appear the way we might have expected, right? In the sense that New England candidates tend to have a backyard advantage in the New Hampshire primary. And right now we have two of the top three candidates from states that neighbor New Hampshire, right? Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have moved. Sanders has been there all along. But Warren, after starting off with somewhat disappointingly in the polls, has bumped up into the top three. And we've seen this surge happen nationally for Elizabeth Warren, but we're starting to see that in New Hampshire as well. And then they're joined by former vice president who has enormous name ID, a lot of goodwill among Democratic voters. So after, you know, this tumultuous 6 months and a lot of to and fro, we're starting to see the field shape up, I think, the way a lot of us might have expected it to early on.
So a hometown advantage is emerging. What else, Dante? What other sort of trends are you seeing in this big field?
You know, I think one of the things that we're observing and having a difficult time sorting out is what's the significance of the New Hampshire primary in a political world that is increasingly nationalized, dominated by social media. And so you're seeing a lot of this happen in the national political reporting, where reporters will point out, boy, this candidate's spending a lot of time in New Hampshire, but he doesn't seem to be benefiting in the polls. Or look at how many states candidates have appeared around the country, not just New Hampshire and Iowa. So there's for a lot of observers, I think we're all looking back to 2016 and thinking about whether that was just one giant aberration or whether 2016 started to shape how future primary cycles, including this one, are going to work themselves out.
Aberration in terms of what, Dante? In terms of where candidates choose to spend their time?
Where they spend their time, but also how they spend their time.
I see.
Like if we think about the winners of the New Hampshire primary last time, Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, you know, they didn't follow the traditional, you start in someone's living room in Epping, New Hampshire, and you work your way up to giant auditoriums by the time of the primary. They ran big rallies. They ran non-traditional campaigns. They had very little party elite support, and yet they won and won convincingly.
Meg, this is something you look at, too, how candidates use media, not just traditional media, but also the emerging platforms of social media.
Absolutely. I think we're still getting a sense of how each candidate's Twitter style varies. And I know that there was a lot of interesting research, not done by me, but done by some of my colleagues, about the role that Twitter has played in past election cycles. So it'll be quite interesting to see what comes out of this cycle. One of the other things I've noticed is, in part because of the incredibly crowded field, everybody is really looking to connect with their micro audiences in different ways. And one interesting example of that is Kamala Harris is going to be writing a monthly column for Essence magazine about policy, about her experiences on the campaign trail. The magazine is not endorsing her, but they are opening up space. And I think this is interesting on two levels. You know, this is a very interesting way for Harris, who is a woman of color, to connect with a magazine whose main audience is women of color. So I find that fascinating, and it'll be interesting to see how that relationship evolves. And I think it also speaks to the renewed attention that women's magazines are getting for their political work, which they've been doing for decades. So yeah, it'll be an interesting dynamic there.
Now, when Dante was talking about, you know, how these candidates are trying to find their audiences and go to other states besides New Hampshire. I've heard of candidates in California, in Michigan. You were nodding there, Meg. So you've done a lot of work on the New Hampshire primary, too. How do you see New Hampshire's role this time around?
I'm not sure. I was nodding along as Dante was talking because I have a lot of questions about it. I think that in part because the field is so crowded, everybody is trying to get out to voters in every way possible. But as Dante was saying, town halls are no longer the only way to do that. There are Facebook ads. There's tweeting. There's the column that we were just talking about with Harris. So I think there are lots of different ways for candidates to reach voters, and it'll be interesting to see it play out.
And this time around, Paul, those national polls are just as important as spending times in living rooms in Epping, as Dante said, because you need those national polls to get on the stage, to get talked about, and so forth. How do you see this whole Democratic field? We'll talk about Republicans in a moment, but how do you see this Democratic field shaking out right now, Paul?
Historically large, first of
yeah.
all. Right? I mean, 23. We thought we had a lot of Republicans last time with 18. This is just astronomical. It makes it extremely difficult for some of the lower tier candidates to grab any attention. You know, they have to kind of wave their hands and say provocative things to get some national attention, let alone attention here in the states. You know, there was a lot of talk about the death of the New Hampshire primary. We hear it every 4 years. We heard it again this time around, especially from out-of-state political reporters. But we're still here. We're still alive. We're still getting plenty of campaign traffic, as are the other early voting states. But yes, with this cycle, there's a new dynamic. California and Texas are now going to be on Super Tuesday, and they both have early voting, which means that their, you know, voting will be coming right around the time that we're voting here in New Hampshire. So they're getting more campaign traffic this time than they did in previous cycles. And yes, it's also very true. I mean, because of social media, this has become a much more of a nationalized campaign. We are still an important place for the candidates to go, but in some ways, we're kind of like the playing field where the action takes place. But they're also going to the others, you know, other early voting states, but also some of the Super Tuesday states. And of course, they need money. So they're going to be going to a lot of the larger states to fundraise. So, yes, the New Hampshire primary, at least for this cycle, is alive and well, but it is being more and more nationalized with every cycle. First, we saw it with the cable news networks back in the 80s and 90s. Then when online became prevalent, and now with social media, that's natural.
It's really interesting what you just said, Paul, about early voting takes place in those big states, mm-hmm. Texas and California, around the same time of the New Hampshire primary. Can you give us a little bit more there? That's really interesting, and I had not heard that before.
Yeah, and that was a big concern a couple months ago that, oh my gosh, California, people will be voting starting early February when Iowa voters caucus and when New Hampshire voters go to the primary, which we believe it'll be February 11th. We'll have to find out for sure from Bill Gardner, the Secretary of State. But, yeah, there was this concern that, candidates won't go here. They'll go to California instead because there's so many more voters and so many more delegates at stake than here in New Hampshire. That has not been the case. Sure, there's been plenty of traffic there, but we're seeing just as much, if not more, this time around here in New Hampshire. Maybe that's because, we have 23 candidates. You do the math. But the New Hampshire primary is still thriving. You mentioned the national polls. That is a different dynamic, though. That is interesting. Remember, to make the debate stage and the first debate start next week, the candidates had to do two things. They had to have 65,000 donors nationwide, and they had to reach 1% in three polls, be them national or state polls. And I think that distracted the campaigns a little bit. Maybe they spent a little less time in Iowa, New Hampshire, or South Carolina, or Nevada, and a little more time building up that donor base or trying to raise their stature a little bit. So maybe there was a little bit of an effect there.
All right. Again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Given how many candidates are out there, we could talk forever about this topic, but I really want to hear from listeners, too. And who are you seeing in your city or town campaigning? Who did you like? Who impressed you? Who left you a little less impressed? And who are you still waiting to hear from? We'd really, really like to get your thoughts in today on all the candidates that we've seen in our cities and towns here in New Hampshire. Join us with a phone call, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, a listener left us a voicemail about who she's supporting and why. Let's hear from her.
Hi, my name is Kate, and I'm actually calling from Exeter, New Hampshire. The candidate that I support is Beto O'Rourke, and primarily because he understands that in order for our country to move forward progressively, we actually need to work together. His policies reflect, I think, his grasp of the intersectionality of the issues. We can't work on immigration without working on climate change. We can't discuss equal rights without first looking at how inequity is a design flaw in so many of our systems. I've heard him speak on all three of his trips to New Hampshire, and I really can't wait until he brings his message back. I don't believe that Better Work is like a return to American values, because I think those values have actually been really easily forsaken and twisted. I do think that I believe very much that he may be the start of our country truly and authentically practicing American values, where everyone is welcome and every voice matters.
Thank you, Kate, for that voicemail. And again, tell us who you have seen out and about campaigning, who you liked, who you were less impressed by. Leave us a voicemail like Kate did. Give us a call now, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So all of you, we talked a lot about how this primary is getting more national due to social media and the fundraising pressures and the polling pressures. But Dante, who is spending a lot of time here in the Granite State?
Well, one, you're seeing a lot of candidates who are long shots, right, spending a lot of time here in New Hampshire. For example, Representative John Delaney spent dozens,
he's been here since 2017.
Yeah, nearing 100, separate visits to New Hampshire. So you're seeing a lot of candidates with a lot of time on their hands, but not a lot of other resources, not the money, not the elite endorsements, not the national poll standing, spending a lot of time here trying to ignite a grassroots campaign that can pay off. But then you're also seeing candidates who are clearly have the stature to be viable nominees. And so you're seeing candidates like, obviously Elizabeth Warren has spent a lot of time here, closing in on, three dozen different visits, events and so forth. And so you're seeing her, especially after starting off the year with less than great polls, really doing the time-honored, we're going to invest a lot of time and resources in this state in order to make sure it pays off next winter.
Let's hear a little bit from Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. And on the campaign trail, she talks a lot about her plans, her policies, but she talks a lot about her background. Here she is saying her mother was able to raise three children and hold on to the family home while working a minimum wage job. Senator Warren says that is not possible now.
Why is it that families today, people today, who work every bit as hard as my mother did, find the road so rocky and so steep? And for people of color, even rockier and even steeper. And the answer is like the answer on minimum wage. It's who government works for. So right now, we've got a government in Washington, that works great for giant drug companies. It's just not working for people trying to get a prescription filled. It works great for investors in private prisons. It's just not working for people whose lives are destroyed and whose communities are torn apart. It works great for giant oil companies that want to drill everywhere, just not for those of us who see climate change bearing down upon us.
Again, that's Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren campaigning in New Hampshire. Who else, Paul, has been spending a lot of time in the Granite State?
I just want to say, Warren, we'll give her credit. She's doing it the New Hampshire way right now. She is, as Dottie said, spending a lot of time here. She's built up the organization, which is important, too. She's got the largest staff of any campaign in the state. This week, along with Cory Booker, she's opening up a field office in Portsmouth. So she's doing a lot of that right. Booker, though, is another one who's spending a lot of time here. This is a state that's important to Cory Booker. Not to negate any other early states, but he's got a lot of friends here. He spent some time here. He's got a large organization campaigning a lot here and hopes that that will pay off. Unlike Warren, who's now soaring in the polls, Booker is not. But a lot of these candidates who are not point out that, you know, now is not the time to get hot. When do you want to get hot? December, January, in the buildup to the actual voting. And a lot of these candidates believe if they put the hard time in now, get the support, get the endorsements, get the grassroots out there, it'll pay off.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, let's play a little bit of Cory Booker. As you said, he has been in New Hampshire a lot. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker. Here he is speaking on WMUR, saying he's not worried that the primary is drawing his party too far to the left, but also adding that during his time as mayor of Newark, it did instill a sense of pragmatism in his approach to politics. Let's hear.
As a mayor, you are a fierce pragmatist. You know, there's a joke from a former mayor long ago used to say there's no Democrat or Republican way to fix a pothole. You just got to fix it. Most of my political career, actually, more years as a mayor than I've been a senator now, are with this fierce urgency to say, hey, people just want you to solve their problems, which forces you not to be stuck in ideological purity. Heck, I had a Republican governor in my state, and I had to find ways to get things done because my neighbors don't care about the speeches I give. They care if things are going to get better. Is there more jobs in our city? Is the school system getting better? So it really forced me to never let ideological purity hold hostage progress for people.
Again, that's New Jersey Senator Cory Booker. Paul, and then Meg, this gets to another sort of definition of this primary field that a lot of people have been making, and I want to know what you all think. Who's progressive? Who's moderate? Who's liberal? Who's conservative? A lot of people have been sort of drawing these little spreadsheets, Paul, you know, mm-hmm. and putting people in the different categories. What do you think of that?
Well, they're right now, the base of the Democratic Party, where is the energy? It's with the progressives. Who's on Twitter? Who's on Facebook making all the noise? It's the progressive wing of the party. There's two obvious candidates who are extremely progressive, Warren and, of course, Bernie Sanders, who calls himself a Democratic Socialist. Plenty of others, though, have been trying to brag about their progressive cred throughout the campaign. And this is also, on the flip side, this is kind of like an early Christmas gift for the Republicans who are saying, look at these Democrats. They're way too far to the left. They're a bunch of socialists. Here's the thing, though. When we actually get to the voting in February, it's going to be a larger Democratic electorate and not just Democrats voting. We're one of 24 states where independents can vote in our primary. So the electorate may be a little more moderate, a little more centrist than where all the energy is right now.
Meg, what do you think?
I think this is a real opportunity for political journalists to move beyond horse race coverage and really push the candidates to define those terms and also to act as educators and to really help voters understand what these terms mean and how they might relate to policies and the dynamics of the race.
Go ahead, you can finish up.
It doesn't necessarily have to be long form. You can do this quickly and briefly and sharply.
Okay, which Paul Steinhauer is very good at. And we'll go back to you, Paul, after a short break. We'll also play a lot more sound of all these candidates on the trail, doing just what you said, Meg, trying to define who they are, what their politics are. Again, we want to hear from you. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email. Tell us who you have seen out campaigning in your community and what you thought. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from UR subscribers and from
Advest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, who's who in the 2020 presidential primary and what issues they're talking about. Democrats are preparing for their double debates next week. Meanwhile, the president kicks off his reelection campaign tonight in Florida, and his lone opponent, Bill Weld, has been doing some campaigning here in New Hampshire. Let's get your thoughts. Who have you seen campaigning in your community? What did you think? Who are you still waiting to hear from? Let us know. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Paul Steinhauser is here, a New Hampshire political reporter. He writes for the Concord Monitor, Seacoast Online, and nationally for Fox News. Dante Scala is with us, professor of political science at UNH, and Meg Heckman, assistant professor at Northeastern University's School of Journalism and a former reporter for the Concord Monitor. And all of you, before we go to our listeners, Paul, I did want to get your thoughts on what Meg said before the break. It was really interesting. We were talking about how the media has been sort of putting all these candidates, and it's understandable, there's so many, in categories. Most liberal, somewhat liberal, moderate, all these labels. And Meg said it was an opportunity for political journalists to dive a little deeper into what these candidates are really saying. And I just wonder what you think about that.
No, it's a great point. And the candidates are actually helping us because we've seen an explosion of policy proposals, most of them progressive, by these candidates. We've seen proposals on issues even like affordable rent, which has become such a huge issue here in New Hampshire. Just this morning, Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, outlining in detail what she would do in her first 100 days. So the candidates are helping us make these delineations.
What do you think, Dante, of these categories?
They're a lot easier for, I think, observers, you know, everyday observers of the process to sound confident about. I think when you actually get to the level of voters talking about their ideology or trying to identify the ideology of candidates, things get a lot more blurry, a lot quicker. And when you're talking about two dozen candidates and trying to sort them out into lanes and so forth. I mean, you know, Paul's right. You know where to put Sanders, you know where to put Warren and so forth. But as for the other 20, that gets a good bit more difficult. And ultimately, the candidate who's going to win the nomination is going to be the candidate who most likely can appeal to all different stripes of the Democratic electorate, from progressives, you know, all the way to moderates, which are, you know, a lot more, there are a lot more moderates in the electorate than there are in Twitter, right?
I remember seeing that New York Times article that showed the map of Democrats on Twitter versus the map of Democrats in general, and that was interesting.
Yeah, it's one explanation for Joe Biden's success so far, is that there are a lot of the electorate is moderate, and so the winning candidate is going to be the one who can appeal to this broad coalition of voters, not just one slice of it, even though that's what we're focusing on now.
Meg, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, and just to build on that, in the interest of creating strong journalistic narratives around the campaign, I think it's important for journalists to constantly be asking themselves what parts of the electorate are not being heard in our stories. You know, Twitter's great. It's super seductive. It's fascinating. But as Dante pointed out, it is not the whole electorate. And so at the same time that the campaigns are getting more and more high tech, there's a real argument to be made for political journalism to get less high tech and just go knock on people's doors and hang out in their living rooms and ask them for long, nuanced answers about what they're thinking and feeling.
Have you been able to do that, Paul, with so many candidates to keep track of?
That's the beauty. You know, when I'm at a campaign event, every time I talk to voters. But remember, those are the energized voters. If you're going to go to a campaign event, you're really into it. So you do need to make the time to go to the coffee shops or knock on doors to voters who are maybe not as plugged in.
People who are just hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and speaking of the narrative, a lot of these candidates I hear framing themselves in a narrative around Bernie Sanders. You know, are they sort of like him, but maybe a little more moderate? Do they pick up some of the voters that he got here in New Hampshire last time around? And let's hear a little bit from Senator Sanders himself. I'm sure all of you have heard Senator Sanders say this. He talks a lot about how last time I ran, people thought I was, you know, too far out there. Now everybody agrees with me. That's what we've been hearing from Senator Sanders on the campaign trail. Here he is speaking in Warner in May on Memorial Day.
In 2016, you sent a profound message all across this country. And you said that the ideas that we believe in are not radical ideas, they're not extreme ideas. These are ideas we need to adopt in the United States. And by giving us a big victory in 2016, you made the whole country wake up about the ideas that we have. So thank you, Warner. Thank you, New Hampshire.
Dante, what do you think about that? I have heard Senator Sanders say that multiple times. What's been his impact on this Democratic field now in the 2020 primary?
Yeah, I do think he's got a case that he's been successful in terms of moving the Democratic Party to become a more progressive party. It's part of an ongoing trend that we've seen for decades where, you know, once upon a time there were conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans. Now those people no longer exist for the most part. And so the problem for Sanders now is, you know, what's his second act, right? In 2016, he had also had the benefit of, if you didn't like Hillary Clinton, there was basically one candidate to go to. And so you saw in New Hampshire, Sanders did well among all sorts of different voters, progressives, but also moderates. This time around, it's a fundamentally different game with an open field. And so it'll be interesting to see whether Sanders and his campaign have thought through, can we do the same old thing we did 4 years ago, or do we have to do something new? And if it's something new, what is it exactly?
And I was at that Warner event. Listen, he's got to step up his game this time. At that Warner event and everywhere else he goes now, guess what he does when it's over? He takes selfies, he waits, and he talks to all the voters. He's doing what other candidates are doing because he has to change. He has to update his campaign a little bit.
Well, let's go to our listeners. Again, tell us what you think. If you have been going to some of these events that we've been talking about, we'd love to get your impressions, who you've seen out campaigning in New Hampshire, what you thought. Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And since we've been talking about Bernie Sanders at that Warner event, Pam is calling from Warner. Hi, Pam. Good to hear from you. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead, Pam.
That event was so exciting. And I just want to make one little point about Bernie Sanders. And I just heard the comments that your guest made. I don't know. I don't seem to agree with that Bernie needs to up his game and change his rhetoric. He's been saying the same thing since the 60s, and I think that's what we all appreciate about him. He is what he is, and he is what he stands for, and he's always stood for the same thing.
And are you going to vote for Sanders this time, Pam?
Absolutely. Well, I say absolutely. I'm still holding out to hear what everyone has to say, and I'll make the logical choice for me. But at this point, I am very much in Sanders' support network, I guess you could say.
Sure.
I started out not impressed with Warren because I didn't think she had any charisma, but I've also been very impressed with some of the interviews that she's given on different stages, so we'll see.
Well, it's really interesting to hear from you, Pam, and I think a lot of people have been wondering, Bernie Sanders got so much support in New Hampshire last time. Where are those folks going to go? Sounds like you're mostly staying with Bernie Sanders, but you could be convinced to go elsewhere.
Yeah, I'd say Bernie's got a good 87% with me.
All right.
But I don't want to sell out. But
we won't hold you to it.
He's 90, and he was not at all interested in Bernie Sanders, and he now is very interested and has learned a lot about him. And I would say he's a Democrat for sure, but he's on the more moderate side.
Okay. It's great to hear from you, Pam. Really appreciate the call. And let's go next to Wolfboro, where Reeve is on the line. Hi, Reeve. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I am talking about Andrew Yang. I heard him first on your show, Laura, a few weeks ago. You had him on for an hour, as you're doing with as many candidates as possible, and I was wowed by that. I thought he sounded incredibly intelligent and had the most overriding, far-arching view of all of the issues and how they wove together. So when I got a chance to, I saw him recently in person just a week or so ago, and I love all the candidates. I actually love almost every single one of the candidates that are running, and I would be content with any of them, but I was stunned when I saw him in person and realized not only is he brilliant, he's not a politician, he's an entrepreneur. But I couldn't tell this from the interview that you did. I just could only see it when I was in person, how unbelievably warm-hearted he is also, and good-humored, and just that a person running for a president would have both a great heart and connected to his brain knocked me out. So,
all right.
I'll just say one more thing, that he has a, instead of the MAGA hat, he has a hat that says MATH, M-A-T-H, and it's for Make America Think Harder.
Oh,
you really have to pay attention to him.
Well, and so you said, Reeve, I love all these candidates. Who else catches your attention besides Andrew Yang?
Well, several of the ones who are leading, although I am ready to be through with old white men for president, I would kind of like to have someone a little bit different. And I like Elizabeth Warren. I like Kamala Harris. I like Buttigieg a lot. I like a lot of these a lot. But let me say one more thing about the coverage that frustrates me, that people easily talk about, and this is on NPR, to whom I'm devoted, that the coverage covers the top three or four and is continually sounding horse racy even when you're not intending to. Since that money can cover itself, it seems to me NPR and NHPR's job is to cover these other people. Yang is growing fast. I think you're going to be, he's drawing from all sides because he's so data-driven and so comprehensive.
Well, Reeve, duly noted, and I do appreciate the comments for sure. It's hard not to jump into horse racy stuff when there are so many, but she's right. We do attempt and should try to attempt more to focus on some of the policies. Since Reeve mentioned Andrew Yang, and she's right, here at NHPR, we've been trying to have all the candidates on for that full hour, a rare commodity in today's sort of hyped up media environment. But let's play a little bit from our interview with Andrew Yang, where he talks about kind of what Reeve talked about, that he's a non-politician and that his background in technology and how it affects the economy, he said, makes him uniquely positioned to become president. Let's hear.
And to me, the reason why Donald Trump is our president today is that we'd automated away 4 million manufacturing jobs in Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Missouri, Iowa, all the swing states he needed to win and did win. And my friends in technology know that what we did to the manufacturing jobs, we are now doing to the retail jobs, the call center jobs, the fast food jobs, and most disastrously soon, the truck driving jobs. So the reason why I'm running for president is that we need to solve the problems that got Donald Trump elected and move our society and economy forward in the 21st century.
Again, that's entrepreneur, businessman Andrew Yang running for president. Meg, our caller Reeve said something that I want to ask you about. She said, I'm kind of tired of older white males. I want something new. How do you hear this dynamic playing out in this large Democratic field, especially since there are, I don't want to do the math too quickly, but six women running?
Okay. There are six women, and that fact is absolutely history-making. And we can hope that it marks a profound change to the gender dynamics that have too long governed civic life in the U.S. But we need to pay really close attention to how their campaigns are covered, because we need to avoid replicating the kind of lopsided coverage that female candidates have received for decades. So there's this whole body of research out there that shows that female candidates are often treated very differently by the media in all sorts of subtle and sometimes not so subtle ways. And that's especially true when they're seeking national office. And that can manifest itself in a number of different ways. There are deep systematic differences. And for instance, the tone of media coverage is really different. So female candidates are often covered more negatively than their male peers. They often receive less coverage than their male peers. And the coverage that they do receive tends to be focused on their appearances, their families, their likability, their personality traits. And we have a real opportunity, because of the sheer number of women running this time around, to just do it better.
Is that reflective of the journalists, or is it reflective of the journalists and the voters? Is that what voters are keying in on when they view these female candidates? Obviously, I'm not talking about all voters, but
right. You know, I think it's all.
Is it a cultural phenomenon that journalists are reflecting?
Absolutely. Gender bias of all kinds, is really sneaky and really pervasive, and we can't end it. I mean, human beings are biased. That's just part of how we're hardwired, but we can be aware of it and seek to check ourselves and just make sure that we are being inclusive and fair.
Paul, go ahead.
It's such a great opportunity this time around because, as Meg just mentioned, yes, six female candidates running. That is historic. But look at some of them. They're in the top tier. Mm-hmm. Of the top five polling candidates right now, we've got a long way to go, but of the top five, you've got Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris right in there. And when we talk about a lot of these candidates, as I just mentioned, like this morning, Klobuchar, another one of the female candidates, putting out another policy proposal. A lot of what I'm talking about is what they're saying when it comes to policy and what their where their poll position is, the strength of their campaign, things like that. So, yeah, I think this campaign is giving us quite an opportunity to get by and get past some of the negative stigmas of years and cycles past.
Go ahead, Meg.
It's far too early to see how this is going to play out over the entirety of the election cycle. I can tell you, though, that some preliminary research I've been doing with my colleagues down at Northeastern shows that the female candidates are receiving more negative coverage than their male peers nationally. And another troubling trend that we identified is that nearly two-thirds of the reporters writing national stories about the race are men. So there's a big gender gap in the political press corps nationally. Now, again, this is ongoing research. This is a series of snapshots. It's not a formal study, but this should definitely be sending up red flags to assignment editors and hiring managers at newsrooms preparing to cover this thing. We need to do a better job as a profession of hiring reporters who are reflective of demographics as a whole.
Well, since you mentioned Kamala Harris, let's hear from her. She is California Senator, former Attorney General of California, describing her family upbringing and how it led her to become a prosecutor.
My parents met when they were active in the civil rights movement. My sister Maya and I, we joke we grew up surrounded by a bunch of adults who spent full time marching and shouting, because they did, about justice, right? I made a conscious decision to become a prosecutor. Because I felt very strongly, one, I knew what was wrong with the criminal justice system, and I thought, well, listen, we have various roles in terms of how we reform systems. I want to go inside and do it from there. And the other piece of it is because I also wanted to be a prosecutor, because I knew that would be the role of also being a voice for vulnerable and voiceless people.
Again, that's California Senator Kamala Harris. You know, Dante, I'd like to ask you about Senator Harris. She's been campaigning around the country, including here in New Hampshire, making a pretty big impact, raising money, getting on the debate stage. I'd just love your thoughts on her candidacy and what it represents.
Yeah, she's a candidate, I think, with right now probably the greatest difference between where she is in the polls and where she could be in the polls, in the sense that she's someone who could possibly, you know, rebuild the coalition of voters that put Barack Obama into the nomination back in 2008. She appeals to a broad spectrum of Democrats. And you look at her, even though in the polling she trails by a good bit, I think at this point it's important to look at things like, what's her overall favorability? You know, would people consider voting for her? Is she people's second choice? And by those metrics, you know, she stands pretty well compared to the rest of the field. And you can never underestimate how fluid voters' intentions are so far out. And that's why you always have to take the polling now, even though we treat it as gospel, we have to take it with a lot of salt, because we've seen candidates over and over again pop up in the last several weeks before a primary.
It's kind of what Paul said earlier. When do you want to be hot? Not necessarily right now, you know, December, January. We will take a lot more of your calls after a short break, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Recently on The Exchange, transgender panelist answer a listener's question about how to talk about those times before their child transitioned.
Just because they've come out as trans does not lessen that experience. Do you still own those memories? And I would say to any parent, those memories are yours of your child. It's just being thoughtful both to what you need as a parent and understanding that your first priority is to make sure that your child is loved.
The Exchange is your place for New Hampshire conversations. Weekday mornings at 9, only on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, the 2020 presidential primary. President Trump prepares to announce his reelection bid with one challenger so far, Bill Weld. Meanwhile, 20 Democratic challengers are preparing for their back-to-back debates next week. We'd like your impressions. Who have you seen? Who are you interested in seeing campaigning here in New Hampshire? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. And Meg Heckman, Dante Scala, Paul Steinhauser, right back to our listeners. Maury is calling in from Portsmouth. Hi, Maury. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, hi. Thank you.
Sure.
Of the last three presidential primaries, I've seen almost all the candidates of both parties who visit the Seacoast, where I'm based, and
wow.
I've run the primary NH blog. So based on all my exposure to them, I just want to make two quick points on how we as voters can extract the most insight when we're vetting these candidates, when we're there in front of them, and I think it involves how we ask questions. One is I think it's important to ask a question based on what you just heard the candidate say in his or her speech, instead of coming with a canned, scripted question about an issue important to you, because you can usually learn about immigration or gun control or whatever their position is on their websites. So we don't really learn anything as voters when you do that. And just two, the follow-up is so critical. It's the give and take that's most revealing, and you really get a window into a particular candidate's character and quick thinking ability if you interrupt politely or even say ahead of time, and after I ask my question, I like to follow up briefly if that's okay.
Some advice for how we talk to these candidates as journalists and voters. Who is attracting your attention, Maury? Who do you like, who you've seen so far?
Well, I like the candidates like Bill Weld or John Delaney, who actually are substantive and actually take more questions and answer succinctly. I mean, I'm just judging on that lens right now, which is the people who actually, as candidates, seem to welcome the chance to dig into the issues, offer specific concrete policy proposals, and actually listen to what the questioner says, and then there's actually an interplay. I mean, Bill Weld took a remarkable, I saw him in Exeter about a month ago, whatever you think of him in his position, he took a remarkable amount of questions and answered them very concisely so that he could take even more questions.
Wow.
Elizabeth Warren, whatever you think of her, she took five questions when I started Portsmouth High School and gave very long answers that strayed far afield from the scope of the questioner's inquiry.
Well, Maury, it's great to hear from you. Since you mentioned Bill Weld, again, if listeners are wondering who's that, he is the only Republican challenger right now to President Trump. He's a former Massachusetts governor. He was on The Exchange. We've been trying to hear from as many candidates as possible. Bill Weld, here in this clip we're going to play, he recalls earlier political times when he says there was more bipartisan cooperation. He says that's why he's running.
Right now, all I see in Washington is people being quiet while President Trump engages in, frankly, outrageous behavior. My hope is that we're going to return to the idealistic party that I call, for shorthand, the Party of Lincoln.
So what do you think about that, Paul Steinhauser? You've covered Bill Weld's visits here in the Granite State.
He's basically camped out here since February when he first started flirting with this. Let's be honest. This is the longest of long shots. Donald Trump remains extremely popular within his own party here in New Hampshire and nationwide. We've seen other potential challengers like Governor Larry Hogan of Maryland, very popular governor right now, say no. He came up here and flirted with the idea and then decided against it. Still don't know about John Kasich. But it is going to be a Herculean task, a real uphill battle for anybody to try to primary challenge this president.
Well, and the president, as we said earlier, kicks off his reelection campaign tonight. We obviously don't have a clip of that because it's tonight. But here's a little bit of a preview from the president at a recent rally. He touts the economy and then he turns to his upcoming reelection campaign and targets some of his many Democratic opponents.
If I win my race and we get it just the way we want it, and I think we're going to win it big, I'm looking at the competition. You sort of dream about competition like that, but who knows? Who knows? I got boot edge. I got them all. I got Beto. Beto's falling fast. What the hell happened? Remember about four weeks ago, he said, I was made for this. He was made for it. He was made to fall like a rock. What happened to him? But he's trying to restart his campaign. That generally doesn't work out too well. Political geniuses, when you have to restart your campaign, history has said that that does not work out well, right? History has said that that's trouble. But he's going to restart his campaign. But I'm looking at it. I don't know what the hell happened to Biden. What happened to him? I'm looking. I said, that doesn't look like the guy I knew. What happened to him?
Again, that's President Trump talking about some of his potential Democratic opponents. So, Dante Scala, I have heard from Democrats who call into the show, who send us emails, who talk to us. A lot of them say the best qualification for a presidential candidate for these people is who can beat President Trump. How much are these Democrats talking about the president and their ability to defeat him on the campaign trail?
Joe Biden's doing that quite a lot, right? I mean, Joe Biden's strategy for becoming the nominee of the Democratic Party is to, as best he can, try to ignore the other 22 candidates running for the nomination and pitch the whole contest as a one-on-one battle between himself and Donald Trump. And so that raises the whole question of electability, which you hear bandied about a lot, you know, by pundits, by the media, that that's what Democrats are obsessed with right now. And, you know, I'm sure that's true to some extent, right? Democrats want to find someone who can beat Donald Trump. However, electability is, like ideology, is a very fluid term, and it's really difficult to figure out exactly how people measure it. You know, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. Electability is right up there with beauty. And once we get to Iowa and New Hampshire, electability is going to be all about who just won the last contest, right? If Joe Biden loses Iowa, his electability is going to look a lot worse than it did before Iowa. So that's one key thing to keep in mind, I think.
Let's go back to our listeners. And Eric's calling from Conway. Hi, Eric. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. I'd like to take issue with, it's the pundits keep, whenever they say, talk about the progressives, it's immediately followed by calling them the far left. And if you look at the polls of the issues of the progressives, they always poll high among independents, even sometimes among Republicans. And I know the Democratic Party has moved to the right over the last few decades. So I don't see how they keep pushing this idea that there's this big moderate vote out there and that the progressive agenda is not really a centrist agenda.
So, Eric, you see the Democratic Party moving to the right in recent years?
Oh, sure, since Clinton and, getting rid of Glass-Steagall, Obama was a Republican health care plan. I mean, you can look at a lot of issues that they just keep following the Republicans to the right.
That's interesting.
And the Republicans move farther to the right.
So, Eric, you're disagreeing with the sort of general narrative that Democrats are moving to the left, pulled by Bernie Sanders' victory here in New Hampshire. You're not buying that.
Well, it is moving back to the center. I mean, I don't know why pundits, they like to use polls when it supports their arguments, but when it doesn't, they ignore them. And if all you got to do is look at the polls on everything from getting money out of politics, universal health care, dealing with climate change, raising the minimum wage, gun regulation, all these issues poll very high in almost everything from independents and Democrats and some Republicans too on some of those issues.
Well, it's really good to hear from you, Eric. And gosh, I'm not sure who to go to on this. Anybody can jump in on it. Eric kind of pushing back on the standard narrative that you do hear from a lot of people. He's saying it's wrong. Paul, I'm going to turn to you. You know, the standard narrative is the Democrats have moved to the left. Eric's saying, no, not really. They're moving back to where they used to be and should be, he seems to be saying.
Well, let's be honest. It is true that Bernie Sanders did help change the conversation for the Democratic Party. And now things like Medicare for All, free college tuition in public universities, voting eligibility laws, climate change, the Green New Deal. Yeah, the party in many ways has embraced now some of these proposals that were considered a little, you know, on the extreme. Now they're not. Now they're part of the mainstream. And you're hearing a lot of these candidates, not just Bernie Sanders anymore, but a lot of these candidates, you know, emphasize these issues. So I think in many ways the party has moved a little further to the left than it was a few years ago, maybe under Barack Obama or under the Clinton presidency.
Dante?
I do think Eric's right in the sense that we do see public opinion during the Trump presidency moving in a more liberal/progressive direction. And public opinion tends to do that in a reactive sort of way. So in other words, when there's a Democrats are in charge, public opinion moves in a conservative way, and then vice versa, almost as if the public is trying to find some sort of balance between the two different ideologies. And nowadays, I think, you know, that you, again, in terms of electability, you know, for an Elizabeth Warren, for example, you can make a plausible argument that the way to win an election against Donald Trump is not to play toward the middle or play toward kind of consensus politics of a bygone era, but rather to go with big progressive ideas. And that will be the thing that attracts people's attention.
Well, let's play a little bit from Pete Buttigieg. And part of the reason I want to play this is because President Trump mentioned him in that clip. But part of the reason I want to play it is Buttigieg, it seems, has been trying to say, I'm more in the middle. I'm not in the Bernie Sanders wing of the party. Here he is in response, actually, to a question you asked him, Paul Steinhauser, on why he calls himself a democratic capitalist and whether, you asked him, is this a shot at Bernie Sanders, a democratic socialist? Let's hear.
No, it's not a shot at anybody. I just think that you can't have capitalism without democracy. And if you want to see what happens when you try to do capitalism without democracy, look at Russia. You get crony capitalism, which turns into oligarchy. If we really want to maintain the productivity and the value of a strong business community, we've got to recognize that growth alone isn't enough. Growth has to actually reach all of us, and that requires good policy. And it has to take place in the framework of a consistent rule of law. Right now, we're living in an era of regulatory capture, when money equals power, and corporations have often used that power in order to purchase policy that privileges their profits over the rest of us.
So again, that's Pete Buttigieg, mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and a veteran. Someone else who has been trying to position herself more in the center of this field is Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York. She spoke recently on The Exchange. She presented herself as a fighter, as a winner, with appeal across the political spectrum. Let's hear.
I've never backed down from a fight. I take on the fights that other people won't, and I actually win. And that's been my story. I've taken on the Pentagon twice, first over Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal, and then over sexual violence in the military. I've taken on Congress many times, first as a member of Congress, posting my earmarks and my schedule and my financial disclosures and taxes online, first person ever to do it, and then actually passing a bill to ban insider trading by members of Congress.
Again, that's Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York. Speaking on The Exchange just last week, you know, Meg Heckman, what do you think about the words that she uses there? I'm a fighter. I'm tough. Do women have to say that more frequently than men in this campaign?
I think they do. And it's tricky because they can also get penalized for appearing to be too tough or too masculine. And so the dynamics are just different. The playing field is different. And it's a little more difficult, sometimes a lot more difficult for female candidates to navigate that.
Let's take another call. This is Senator John Morgan calling in from Brentwood. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you all?
Fine. Go ahead.
Great. Thanks. I just wanted to take a moment because I endorsed Cory Booker very early on, and I was the first state senator to endorse anyone in this race. And I just want to share very briefly why I decided to do that. You know, this is really the most divisive period in my lifetime, and I think it's really important that we find someone to lead our party, someone who has both executive experience as well as legislative, someone who's proven track record, but most importantly, someone who beating Donald Trump is literally just the floor. And Cory Booker is really that person. You know, he does talk about beating Donald Trump and how we absolutely have to do that. But that's really just the beginning. And so I couldn't be more proud to have endorsed Senator Booker early on and to be standing with him in this long marathon of a race. And I just think he's absolutely the right person.
Well, marathon is the right word, and I really appreciate you calling in. Katie also sent us an email. Katie says, I haven't entirely made up my mind yet, but I'm trying to see candidates. Unfortunately, they don't seem to, quote, get New Hampshire's level of civic engagement. I've tried twice to see Pete Buttigieg, but have never been able to get in. Same with Kamala Harris. The only candidate I've met is Elizabeth Warren, and that's because on Election Day in November 2016, she showed up at UNH. I was driving students to the polls. The students didn't have a clue who she was, but she came right up to the bus, shook my hand, introduced herself to all the students, and thanked them for voting. It was such a quintessentially New Hampshire moment. How could I not be impressed? You know, Katie, thank you so much for the email. This is really interesting, Paul. Have some of these events already, I mean, it's only June, have they already been getting so crowded that if you want to see someone, you can't get in?
Yeah, that's been the case. One of the times Buttigieg was here, he had to move to a larger venue because of the excitement around his campaign. And that's a great story for the campaigns. That's what they want. Sometimes maybe they'll pick a venue that's a little too small because they want that picture of people waiting outside. Candidate has to go outside and talk to them first. But we're starting to get more and more interest now in this campaign. And especially when we get past Labor Day, I think you're going to see the crowds get even bigger for many of these candidates.
Dante?
Yeah, all signs are pointing to record voter engagement, you know, from anecdotal evidence of, you know, people selling out town hall meetings and, you know, having to wait for hours to see candidates, to polling that shows that interest in the 2020 election is right now it's at a peak that you don't normally see until right before an election. So really all signs are pointing to record turnout, I think, for the primary next February, but then also for the general election in November.
And as a political scientist, Dante, when you see a lot of Democrats coming out for these presidential primary races, how does that translate to the elections here in New Hampshire for U.S. Senate and Congress and so forth?
I think it gives some worry to Republicans simply because, you know, there's no activity. There's nothing to stir up your own side. I mean, maybe the president will be here, maybe he won't be, but that's no substitute for having two dozen candidates appearing all the time, generating lots of excitement. It reminds me of 2004 with John Kerry and Howard Dean. Guess the amount of excitement that stirred up carried all the way through until November.
Meg, real quick, what are you going to be looking for in terms of coverage? What are your hopes that journalists will focus on?
Like I said before, now is the time for nuance. Back off from the horse race. We've got plenty of time for that. It's 8 or 9 months till the New Hampshire primary, even longer until the general election. So I hope that journalists look for nuance, and then hiring editors, make sure your newsrooms are diverse. Make sure your press corps is diverse.
All right. Given the diversity that we're seeing in this field.
Exactly.
All of you, thank you very much for coming in. Meg, it was great to see you.
Thank you.
And Paul Steinhauser, always a pleasure. Thank you for helping us out.
Thank you, Laura.
And Dante Scala, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Laura.
This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.